at the Feast of Tabernacles, a feast of celebration of God's faithfulness to Israel following their exodus from Egypt. The people had celebrated with various sacrifices, with the bringing of various offerings, and also with various rituals that had developed over the centuries, one of which was a ritual of pouring out water at the altar, a ritual that was to commemorate God's faithfulness in sending the rains that had nourished and produced the crops which they were celebrating the ingathering of at that time. The other ritual that had developed was that of the lighting of lamps in the temple each evening of the Feast of Tabernacles. And it was at the conclusion of that feast that Jesus had proclaimed in the courts of the temple that he was the water of life and that he was the light of the world. It's a theme that we find picked up again in the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John, though it would appear that some time has actually passed. There are two clues to that reality. One is in chapter 10, where the ongoing dialogue that goes on between Jesus and his disciples and the Jews, in the midst of that, we're told that the time of the Feast of Dedication was to take place at Jerusalem. Well, that feast was to take place 3 months after the Feast of Tabernacles. We also have a hint that some time has passed, because in the previous dialogue that Jesus had with the Jews, he had declared that before Abraham was, I am. And they had picked up stones to throw at him, and Jesus had hidden himself and went out of the temple. Now, if we saw the opening words of chapter 9 being attached, if you like, to chapter 8, it would be rather puzzling. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth and proceeded to heal him and to enter into a new discussion with men who had just taken up stones to try and stone him. It doesn't make sense. So some time has passed, but you see, in John's mind, there is a strong link in his unfolding of the narrative of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, through which he is seeking to convince his Jewish brothers and Gentile proselytes to Judaism that this Jesus is indeed the Christ that they are awaiting. In John's mind, he sees a flow. And indeed, he uses the words of Jesus in his discussion with the disciples to demonstrate this flow and this link. As Jesus passed by at some point somewhere in the city of Jerusalem, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples enter into a theological discussion with him, a discussion on the connection between sin and suffering. Who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born blind? Well, we may chuckle and think this is a rather silly question. How could a man born blind have sinned such that blindness became his punishment? But you see, the Jews did believe that a baby in the womb could commit sin. And therefore, naturally, the question arises from that context: did this man sin? And is his blindness the result of his sin? Or did his parents sin? For again, the sin of a person's parents could result in suffering, punishment coming to a baby. So then, again, the man could be born blind on account of his parents' sin. Who sinned? And was sin the cause of this man's blindness? Sin certainly is the cause of blindness. It was the sin of our first parents, Adam and Eve, that caused a curse to come upon this world in which we live, and for men and women throughout the ages then to experience all kinds of suffering and every kind of ailment and disease. This is the result of sin. And the scriptures affirm that this is the case. Suffering came into the world because of sin. The problem comes when you seek to attribute every instance of suffering to a particular sin. Whether it's the sin of a man born blind or his parents, or whether it's the sins of a nation that would bring famine, earthquake, pestilence, terrorist attacks, or any other kind of disaster. Jesus himself warned against the dangers of thinking that as long as you lived an upright life, you would be fine, and that it was only those who sinned who experienced suffering. And Jesus declares here that there is no connection between this man's blindness and any specific sin committed either by himself before he was born in his mother's womb or by his parents. It was not this man who sinned or his parents. God had a greater purpose in this man's lifelong blindness. He was blind so that the works of God might be displayed in him. The classic example, I suppose, of this unfolding of the relationship between sin and suffering and the reality that there is no direct relationship in the life of an individual, not necessarily so anyway, is the life of Job, who again, we could say, suffered that the works of God might be displayed in him. Of course, Job never knew. We sit on the sidelines and we look at scenes unfolding that Job was completely ignorant of. As far as we know, to the day that he died, he never knew of a conference taking place in heaven between Satan and God, in which an agreement was made that Satan would be allowed to afflict Job in the very way that he did, so that he lost all of his wealth, all of his health, all of his offspring in a matter of days, and had to endure day after day after day, possibly week, possibly month after month. We don't know exactly how long his suffering went on. And he endured it all, and he didn't know why. And many times he asked, "Why am I suffering in this way? I am innocent. I haven't done anything that would bring on me this kind of suffering as a direct punishment for my sin." Of course, his friends thought otherwise. Just as Jesus' disciples here seem to think otherwise. They assume that because this man is blind, he or someone connected with him must have sinned. But God, in the midst of our lives, is working out his purposes for his own glory. And this is what is happening here. And so as this scene unfolds before us, we need to be looking at it and saying, what then is being displayed? What work of God is being done? And what is being shown to us by this? Is it simply a healing? Jesus healed many people, and of course we draw from that various parallels and spiritual significance. But here, the words of Jesus are intended to put us on alert. Sometimes I think we draw spiritual significance from where there is none. But in this particular instance, we ought to be looking for some significance, because the words of Jesus tell us it's there. And as soon as he has spoken these words, he begins to act. He begins to do something for this man. And note the miracle itself, this sign that is being worked out. Jesus spits on the ground, he makes mud with the saliva, he anoints the man's eyes with the mud and says to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And so he went and washed and came back seeing. And the neighbours and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this the man who sat and begged? Some said it is, some said no, but it's very much like him. A man blind from birth. He has never been able to see. And he has lived his life as a beggar. Couldn't do anything else. And Jesus comes along one day and sees this man and suddenly begins to act and to do something. Whether there's any significance in the procedure that Jesus uses to restore the sight to this man who was born blind is very much debated. Why did he make mud from the earth and saliva and anoint the man's eyes in this way? There's much debate, and I think we must conclude that without any clearer indication that there's significance in the actual way that Jesus healed, we must say it was just the way that he chose to heal. But John does point out that the man was told to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. And he takes the time to explain that Siloam means sent. It is actually the Greek transliteration of the Hebrew Shiloah. And it's linked with the word Shiloh, which we find in the book of Genesis. At the end of the book of Genesis, in the blessings of Jacob upon his sons. In chapter 49 and verse 10, we're told concerning Judah, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. My translation says, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. But the Hebrew literally says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And that word Shiloh has been connected with the coming Messiah. It was all part then of what the Jews understood in terms of the coming Messiah. Its connection with the pool of Siloam is perhaps only in terms of the name, but nevertheless, in the book of Isaiah, we have another prophecy in Isaiah chapter 8 and in verse 6. The Lord spoke to me again, because this people have refused the waters of Shiloh that flow gently and rejoice over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory. They've refused the waters of Shiloh, and God is bringing against them other waters. What are those waters? They're the king of Assyria. In other words, they've refused one king, and God is going to punish them by means of another king. They have indeed rejected the promised one, the Messiah. That is the reality, isn't it, of the unfolding of the Gospel of John. This is what John is repeatedly telling his readers, Jewish readers, or Gentile converts to Judaism, as we've already observed. He's telling them that the Jews, time and time again, through the life of Jesus, rejected him. Over and over and over again, they rejected him. And here it is, it's coming out again in this story of the healing of the blind man. Jesus, the Messiah, the sent one. Is he being rejected again? The Messiah, you see, was to give light, and he was to give sight. Isaiah, in a number of places, and we'll just quickly observe two of them, foresaw that the Messiah who was to come would bring healing to people. In chapter 29 and verse 18, he specifically says, "In that day the deaf shall hear the words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind shall see." And again in chapter 35 and verse 5, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped." You see, in the mind of John, as he writes his record of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, he understands Jesus to be Shiloh. He understands Jesus to be the river who is the rightful king of Israel. He understands Jesus to be the sent one, the Messiah who will bring healing to those who receive him. And it's with that understanding then that he records this miracle. A miracle of a man born blind, never ever having been able to see, being given sight. The neighbors are amazed. In fact, they are so amazed at what has happened that many of them just think that it's a lookalike. It cannot possibly be the man that they have known for so many years who had to beg in order to feed and clothe himself. "It's not the man," they say. "It's very like him, but it's not him." Others think, "Well, it certainly looks like him. I think it is him." And he repeatedly says, "I am the man." And what are the results of the miracle? Well, the results are twofold. In the first place, to state the obvious, the miracle gave sight to a blind man. But remember, this is a sign. It points to far more than the giving of physical sight, as the story itself demonstrates as it unfolds. Yes, this man came back from the pool of Siloam having washed himself, seeing. But he began to see far more than perhaps he ever had imagined before. He was a man born blind. That was his state prior to Jesus visiting him on this day. The Jews, later in their discussion with him, make a very important point. You were, they tell him, born in utter sin. And it's true, you see. This man was born blind. He was also born a sinner. And this whole miracle is intended to demonstrate to us that there is far more important and significant a blindness. Not the blindness of our physical eyes, but spiritual blindness. And what we see in this man is not only the giving of physical sight to a man born blind, but we begin to see the giving of a spiritual sight to a man born a sinner. Look at it as it unfolds for us here. His neighbors and friends say to him, how were your eyes opened? And he said to them, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes. When the Pharisees interrogate him first of all, they ask him, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? And as the day has gone on and as he's thought about the things that he's experienced, he's come to the conclusion, not just that he's the man called Jesus, but he's a prophet. In the second interrogation, which begins at verse 24 of this chapter, the Jews call on this man to give glory to God. We know that this man, i.e. Jesus, is a sinner. They're not saying to him, don't glorify Jesus, glorify God for your healing. No, what they're actually saying to him is, acknowledge God's rule and come clean with us. Tell us the truth. That's what the phrase basically means. And he answered, I don't know whether or not he's a sinner, but one thing I do know, I was blind, now I see. He has opened my eyes. This is a development on the previous statement. He's a prophet. But the man is beginning to see that this isn't just any prophet. This man is more than just a regular prophet. He's a special prophet. He's opened my eyes. I mean, the man is beginning to get a bit dumbstruck about those who are interrogating him. This is an amazing thing, he says. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. In other words, he's saying, well, you may not know where he comes from, but I'm beginning to understand where he comes from. He's fulfilling the prophecies, you see. He's giving sight to the blind. God must be with him. Indeed, he says in verse 33, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. He has done something, therefore he is from God. But then Jesus comes to him a second time and speaks to him "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. From knowing about a man called Jesus, this man saw that Jesus is the Christ. This is the message that John wants to communicate to his readers. Jesus of Nazareth, the man Jesus, is the Christ. He is the Messiah. And this man, who prior to meeting Jesus was a blind man, having met Jesus, is a sighted man in more ways than one. And after his second encounter with, or rather before his second encounter with Jesus, after having met Jesus and having understood who Jesus was, this man is a committed man. He's willing to be counted as one of Jesus' disciples, despite the fact it means being cast out of the synagogue. His parents, during their interrogation, were very cagey about what they were willing to confess to the Pharisees. Yes, they would confess this man was their son. Yes, he was born blind. Obviously, he can now see how it's happened. They don't know. Well, they probably do. But they're not willing to acknowledge what they've been told has happened, because we're told the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He's of age, ask him." And he willingly, readily, indeed even eagerly, is willing to take on these Pharisees. He debates with them. An uneducated, blind beggar. And for his pains, he's cast out of the synagogue, the place of worship, of learning. He's willing to be counted a disciple of Christ. You see, something real has happened in this man's life. He can see, not just with these eyes. He's seen Jesus, the Son of God. That's one result of the miracle. The other result is the exact opposite. Blindness. And we see that in the Pharisees, don't we? These religious leaders who study the word, know the word, can profess to obey the word of God. And the neighbours of this man, we're told in verse 13, brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, we mustn't think that they had any negative purpose in doing this. They're not trying to cause trouble to this man. They're probably wanting an explanation for such an incredible miracle. Unfortunately, it was a Sabbath day. Jesus had made mud and opened the man's eyes on the Sabbath day. And the Pharisees asked him how he received his sight, and he tells them, "He put mud on my eyes, I washed, I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man," i.e. Jesus, "is not from God. He can't be from God. He doesn't keep the Sabbath." He's a sinner. Others say, well, can a sinner do such signs? And there's division among these Pharisees on exactly what these events mean. After all, he is a Sabbath breaker. He's healed on the Sabbath. Well, that was not appropriate, unless it was a mortal illness that was being healed. But in this case, obviously, the man had lived so long since his birth and had been blind all along, it wasn't a mortal illness. Jesus had made mud, which would have involved kneading, mixing. And that was illegal. And if you were a particularly strict Jew, anointing eyes on the Sabbath day was also illegal. So, three strikes and he's out. Jesus is not a good man. Jesus is a sinner. But what then happened? You see, for some, it's cut and dried. He cannot be sent from God. He doesn't keep God's law. For others, whether any of these Pharisees themselves, I'm not sure, but perhaps for some of the onlookers, and probably for the man himself, the question arises, is our understanding of the law correct? If this man can work by the power of God, and so obviously have God's blessing upon him, and he's doing all of this on the Sabbath day, have we interpreted the law wrongly rather than interpreting the man wrongly? And there is division. And they ask him, well, what do you say about him since he's opened your eyes? He says, it's obvious, he's a prophet. And the Jews did not believe. They didn't believe that he had been blind. They didn't believe that he had been blind and received his sight. The answer to the problem is that the man never was blind in the first place. And so they display their doubt. And they call on the parents and ask them, is this your son? Was he born blind? How does he now see? And they say, well, yes, this is our son, and yes, he was born blind. It is the same man, despite the neighbours wondering and questioning and thinking it may just be a lookalike. He was born blind, he does now see. But these religious leaders, nevertheless, are confirmed in their denial that Jesus has anything to do with God. Jesus could not be the Messiah. He could not be the sent one from God. After all, these people are devout disciples of Moses. And the prophet who was to come would be like Moses. And surely they would have an equal zeal for the law of Moses. And so they say to this man, when he possibly tongue in cheek asks them, do you also want to be his disciples? Say to him, you're his disciple, we're Moses' disciple. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we don't know where he comes from. God spoke to Moses. God gave the law through Moses. They exalt the law. And anyone who was to come claiming to be the Messiah would exalt the law as well. But Jesus of Nazareth doesn't seem to have any zeal for the law. But of course they failed miserably to understand both the law's purpose and the law's context. The context of the giving of the law is what? The Exodus. The context of the giving of the law is salvation, of deliverance. And within the body of law that the Israelites were given were many, many further pointers to the deliverer who was to come. The whole sacrificial system were signs, types, pictures that pointed to the salvation that was to come. The whole of the law then is given in the context of mercy, of grace, of salvation. But they've clung to the law as a way of life, and a way of life that will ultimately condemn them because they cannot keep the law, but they've shrugged off everything else that it points to. Whereas Jesus, who is a prophet like Moses, understands the context, understands the significance, and his focus is on bringing salvation to the world. I am the light of the world. And what does light do? Well, light reveals. But light also casts shadows. And this light has penetrated into the life of a blind man and given him sight. But this light has also cast a shadow over the Pharisees who think they see, and has plunged them into their own darkness. Jesus says, presumably to the man born blind, but overheard by the Pharisees, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." It's not a contradiction of what has been said earlier, for example, in chapter 3, where it tells us that he did not come to condemn the world, but that the world through him might live. It's not a contradiction of that, but it's a demonstration that in coming to save some, he inevitably condemns others. A judgment is made that some will receive the light and see, and others will be blinded by that same light. The Pharisees asked him, "Are we blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." In other words, what he's saying to these Pharisees is that they claim to understand. They claim to know the truth. And that very claim is blinding them. If they were really blind, if they said, I don't know, I don't understand, they wouldn't have any guilt. They are guilty of rejecting the Messiah, rejecting Shiloh, rejecting the one who carries the scepter of Judah. But they don't see it. They're blind to it. And John doesn't want his readers to conclude as these Pharisees have done, that Jesus is not the Christ. Rather, in presenting this story, he's encouraging them to come to the light. He's encouraging them to cast off their prejudices, their preconceived ideas of what the law may or may not teach, and allow God to teach them. Will they reject Jesus as so many before them have done? John's longing is that they should believe that Jesus is the Christ. Question, of course, for us is, am I walking in the light or not? Is this light shining into my life, and is it revealing the truth, or am I rejecting the light? You see, this whole story demonstrates that Jesus does have the authority to claim the things that he claims to be a river of living water, the water of life, to claim to be the light of the world, that whoever follows him will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. This blind man became a follower of Jesus. Are you a follower of Jesus?